the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 147, covering the week of November 19th through November 23rd, 2018. Glad to have you back on the program. Glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute, like our Facebook page at Abbeville Institute, and of course, subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville Institute. You can find all those social media buttons at the top of our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org, A-B-B-E-V-I-L-L-E, institute.org. You can also give us an email address. We'll give you a free ebook, and you'll get our Daily Dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email on Saturday or Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast. You can also get our free mobile app. Just go to your favorite application store, Google Play, iTunes, or Apple Podcast, and you can pick up this particular podcast through that way. You can also get our application through your Apple Store. And again, that's free of charge. You are able to get this podcast through that app. You're able to get our lectures through that app, which are over 200 in number. You're able to also have a mobile access to the website. So it's a free app. You're going to want to get it, Abbeville Institute on the go. Also, you can support the Abbeville Institute by going to our webpage again, abbevilleinstitute.org. At the top of the page, you'll see a tab that says support. You'll have donations, donation options. Click on that and you can donate monthly or annually. And of course, all of your donations going to a good cause. They help us explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. They help keep the website going, the podcast going, all of our conferences, scholarships. All these things are vital to the Southern tradition. So we appreciate every dollar you send us, whether it's monthly or annually, as little as you can or as much as you can. It's all appreciated and welcomed. Okay, well, this is an interesting week. Of course, it's a Yankee Thanksgiving week. So we had a full week of articles, though. And one of the things that we have to remember about Thanksgiving, and I say it's Yankee Thanksgiving week, and of course, you know, we all take that time off and enjoy the time with our families. But the first Thanksgivings in America were not held in Plymouth, Massachusetts. They were held in the South. And the piece on Thursday, it's a travel piece, and it's written by an Abbeville Institute supporter, Brett Moffitt. But it's about traveling around North Carolina and how wonderful it is to tour Dixie and to see what the South has to offer. And I think that we forget this oftentimes. You know, we had this, and I've talked about it before on this podcast, we have this perspective in America of North over South. What the North did was real American history. The South is this kind of insignificant other. And one of the things I find that we have because of the influence of ultimately Northern churches in the South is that our perspective on Thanksgiving has been skewed by that North over South. And that comes to just about everything. People want to, if they want to explore, for example, the American founding, they go North. They go up to Philadelphia. They go to Boston. But there's a lot in the South to examine. I mean, a lot of people know about Jamestown, of course, in Williamsburg, but Jamestown is often seen as the other. You know, those are the odd people. We got to go to the pure Americans there in Plymouth. And if you go up there, the interpretation is, of course, that Plymouth did everything first. This is just completely not true. We ran a piece a couple of years back written by Lyon Gardner Tyler, who I did a talk on for the summer school a couple of years ago. And it was entitled Virginia First and How Everything Started in Virginia. Now, this is something that a lot of people don't know. And if you study American history enough, you know this is true. But a lot of times in your education, in your public schools, whether it's junior high school, elementary school even, you're going to focus more on Plymouth than anything else. Thankfully, there's other options out there now besides your public school education. Even the public school teachers that get it right, they have a tremendous wave of propaganda against them, and that would be the first Thanksgiving and the Plymouth colony and, of course, the Pilgrims. And again, a lot of that had to do with the influence of the Puritan churches, ultimately, and the fact that the North won the war, which had a heavy influence on Southern history. Southerners tried to push back against this in the postbellum period, oftentimes without success. And of course, they're criticized for that. How dare they say that all these things came out of the South? This is just evil people in the South. But we had two Thanksgivings in the South before the 1621 event in Plymouth, Massachusetts. The first was held, of course, in Florida, but it was just a one-off event. It wasn't an annual event. And the same thing, we talk about Memorial Day, where we had a one-off event in Charleston from former slaves. And now people like David Blight run around saying, well, that's the first Memorial Day. Everything was based on that. No, it wasn't. I mean, it was a celebration in honor of the Union soldiers who had been killed. And it was a type of Memorial Day event, but it was a one-off event. It wasn't an annual event. The first annual event was held by women who were honoring Confederate soldiers, and that turned into Decoration Day, which then turned into the Grand Army, Union Army, the Union Army Veterans, Grand Army of the Republic, emulating that and creating Memorial Day. So that was the first Memorial Day. And just like we had the first Thanksgiving, the one-off event, but we did have an annual event in Virginia first at Barclay Hundred, 2 years before the Pilgrims decided to have their annual event in Massachusetts. It just so happens that these individuals in Virginia were slaughtered by the Powhatan. So the event was lost to time. But we had two Thanksgivings before we had the event there in Plymouth. So people had forgotten this. But the first Thanksgiving was held in the South. The first annual Thanksgiving was held in the South. And it's important to know your Southern history. So I like this little piece by Brett Moffitt. And just traveling around North Carolina. Some of these sites, of course, were damaged by the recent hurricanes and flooding. But they'll be fixed. They'll be back. So when you're thinking about traveling and you're thinking about exploring history, explore Southern history. Get out and see your own backyard. There's a lot to see in the South. There's a rich history in the South. There's 400 years of history in the South. That's an important part of understanding this Southern tradition. What is true and valuable in the Southern tradition? See your own backyard first. Understand your own people first. It's not a bad thing to do. I know a lot of people like to explore the exotic or the places that are, you know, outside of their backyard because their backyard is just the same thing. But it's important to understand where you're from and who your people are, particularly if you've lived in this area for hundreds of years, your family has, or even a couple of hundred years, or even 100 years. Explore Southern history. And this piece does a nice job in looking at Southern history in North Carolina. Do that in your own state, not just North Carolina, but every state in Dixie. There's a wonderful history in your area. And find out what it is. Look at that first. And that will help you think locally, act locally, as I like to say. And even Brett said that in the piece. But also, the Southern tradition, in order for the political part of it to work, and we've mentioned this before on this show, you have to have something real to hang on to, something tangible. And that tradition, that history, that locality, that's what you're hanging on to. The people there, that's what you're defending. That's what the states serve as a hedge against. Those things. Hang on to that stuff. Understand those things. Understand your history, your local history, your state history, because that's more important ultimately in your daily life than anything else. So I like that piece. This week was dedicated to literature more than anything else, but in that same vein with local history, the piece on Tuesday, which is about a black plantation owner in Louisiana. This again is part of that local history that's often not discussed. I know that there are people that do talk about black slave owners. They talk about the complexities of Southern history and how everything was not one way or the other. And there were a large number of black slave owners in Louisiana, also in South Carolina. Larry Koger wrote an interesting book about black slave owners in South Carolina. I'll never forget when a colleague of mine came into my office years ago. This is probably about a decade ago now. And I had that Koger book sitting on a bookshelf, and he looked at it, and he said, "Black slave owners? Never even heard of that." There are actually black slave owners? Well, yeah. And in fact, there are black slave owners that had large plantations. And the piece on Tuesday by Vito Musumeli, a black sugar planter in the Old South, it's about a book entitled Andrew Durnford, A Black Sugar Planter in the Antebellum South. So we changed the title to Old South. But It gets into this, this was written, published by Transaction Publishers in 1995, so it's not a new book. But the Durnford family is well aware of the fact that their one of their ancestors was black, and he had a large plantation, slave owner. This was not uncommon in Louisiana. This is not uncommon in areas of, in certain parts of South Carolina. Because of the complexity and the racial complexity of these areas, in particular in Louisiana, because you had so many different strains of European settlement in those areas, then of course the different races in those areas. So you had a large free black slave-owning population around New Orleans and the Lowcountry of Louisiana. And this is something a lot of people don't know about. I mean, they think when they think of Southern society, it's black and white, rich and poor, you know, one master race oppressing the other. But it's there's a lot more complexity than that. You know, for example, the Siamese twins, the original Siamese twins, had plantation and owned slaves from Siam, and their sons went off and fought in the Confederacy. So you know, here you have these Asian Confederates. I mean, there are exceptions to what people think are the rule, and there is complexity in the Old South, and that's something that you don't get in your very cartoonish version of American history. The Pilgrims had the first Thanksgiving, the South of the bad guys, the South was like this, the North was like this. We had this pure, noble North against these evil Southerners. I mean, this is generally what you get. It lacks complexity and understanding. The point of history, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago in this podcast, is to understand. If you don't understand, then you can't really grasp the importance of history. It's to understand, not to pass judgment, but to understand these people. And that's what I like about this piece. It's about understanding. And so, as Sam Smith warned, you know, we don't need a Whiggish interpretation of history. You can use history as examples. Well, I mean, the Romans were well aware of this. Livy was well aware of this. History is the best medicine for a sick mind. You have good things to emulate, bad things to avoid. Or, as he said, rotten things, his quote, but bad things to avoid. That's why we study history. It is to get examples, but it's also to understand the remembered past. And I think this piece goes a long way to doing that. And so Vito's done a nice job in this review. And you should read it. You should get the book, read it, understand the complexity of the Old South, understand the complexity of the people in the Old South, and how these people interacted with each other, and how that formed a Southern mosaic. As I mentioned in a piece last week, the South is a mosaic. The South is also a garden, as Robert Peters said. It's a garden in need of cultivation. And I think that's something that we miss. If we're always focusing on something else, we miss that. Southerners have always been good about understanding their own people. And they've been castigated for this and called all kinds of names for it. You know, they laughed at. These Southerners are more interested in their family than anything else. That's a good thing. That's an excellent thing, to be more interested in your family than anything else. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with being clannish? What's wrong with being interested in your own people and in your community? What's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. We put great value on being cosmopolitan, and being cosmopolitan is not always a good thing. There was an article written a little while back about the impact that moving around a lot has on children. People are, I know that, you know, throughout human history you've had nomads, but as we've developed civilization, people have become much more interested in cultivating culture, and civilization requires that, and it also requires a certain amount of being sedentary, being from a place. It creates a worth, a value. It creates comfort. What's better than your own house, your own land, your own place, and your own people? It creates a comfort level that people need when you're constantly moving and you're afraid, you have insecurities for various reasons. You don't have the same comfort. You don't have the same attachment to something. You don't have the same sense of community. And that creates, it's a cosmopolitan worldview. It's very much Benjamin Franklin as opposed to Thomas Jefferson. You know, that's an interesting split there in the founding generation. Both were considered to be cosmopolitan, but Jefferson was a man of his mountains. Franklin was a man of the world, and that mattered. And how they viewed the world. They were both reformers in their own way. Both were men of science, but Jefferson was also a Virginian. Franklin was just a man of the world, so to speak. And so there's a dichotomy there that's important to understand. And having a place and a people and a culture and having a root somewhere, that's important. There's a large number of Americans now that just travel around. They get an RV and they just travel around. That's nice, I mean, to travel and see things, but they have no roots. What's better than going, since this is Thanksgiving week, going to grandma's or grandpa's on Thanksgiving and having that meal with your family? That's the importance of it, Christmas, and having that place that you're from, that you defend, that you know. And so Southerners have been better at doing this. There's a lot of New Englanders and Northerners that have this same attachment to place, no question about it. But Southerners have been more known for it than any other people in America. And that's a good thing. That's an excellent thing. It's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to be interested in your own people. That's why I like this piece and why I liked Moffat's piece this week, and understanding your own people and your own place, your own background. And in that vein, you have the piece on Wednesday, Poe of Virginia. And so we had a couple of pieces dedicated to literature this week, which I found interesting. One was actually a piece of fiction by Jim Kibler, which I'll get into in a minute. So we had two, you know, kind of fantasy pieces bookending the week, Monday and Friday. But the piece on Wednesday, Poe of Virginia. Edgar Allan Poe was a Virginian. And this particular piece concludes that if Poe had lived long enough, he would have been a Confederate. No doubt about it. And Poe was appalled by democracy. Poe was a product of the Romantic era, but a conservative who defended his own place and people. I mean, this man was often criticized for being too Southern. And we look at Poe as this American now. You see, that's what he is. He's just, we're going to study American literature. Poe has been co-opted by the North as one of theirs. And of course, this man who invented American horror and the American detective story. Poe was a product of his place. Poe was a product of his people, which was the South. It was Virginia. There couldn't have been a Poe without it. And so that's the interesting part of Poe. He was critical of Jefferson's America, of Jeffersonianism. He thought it was, you know, Jeffersonian democracy was a dangerous thing. So he was very conservative, but he was very much interested in the South. And I love that part. You know, Robert E. Mary wrote this. I love that about understanding who Edgar Allan Poe was. Poe was something more than just bizarre and amoral, as he says in the beginning of the piece. This is what you get from Poe. You know, he died in a gutter wearing somebody else's clothes, married to his cousin. So he's just bizarre, strange character, amoral. And that his mind was just a mess. Poe was a deep thinker, and he was a man attached to his people and his place. He was a Virginian. And so the title of this piece is Poe of Virginia. It's important to understand that. Again, what the South brings to the table. What is Southern culture and the Southern tradition? What does it have? How is this mosaic created? And it's not just the political part of the Southern tradition, but the literature, which is Poe, the music, the art, the food. How much of Thanksgiving and our Thanksgiving feast in the South is different from that of the North? I mean, we all, you know, we're going to have the turkey, we're going to have the trimmings, but in the South, I mean, you can have all kinds of, your Thanksgiving can be different based on the regional flair of the food. And I remember when I was I went back to visit my folks, and there was a lady there And she was from Cleveland, African-American lady. And she said that she was going to have an African-American Thanksgiving. I said, oh, yeah, what's that? She said, we're going to have black-eyed peas. We're going to have cornbread. And she called it a soul food Thanksgiving. We're going to have that, African-American soul food Thanksgiving. I said, so you're going to have a Southern Thanksgiving? No. I said, African-American, you know, this thing. You know, butter beans. So she was going to have what they eat in the South, because that's where all that came from. I mean, that regional flair, what people call soul food or African-American food, it's Southern food. this is what people in the South ate. You know, so it's just, you have to understand the complexity. And it doesn't matter what race you were, and this is what you ate. And this is what you had, that regional flair. It's great to go to the coast on Thanksgiving and get some shrimp and some fish to eat. And so Southerners ate a lot of that. It's great to have those things on Thanksgiving. You don't have to have just turkey. You have other things, too. Turkey's great, ham, roast beef. But to have these other regional dishes adds something to it. And, of course, that's part of the Southern tradition as well. So, and a good part of the Southern tradition is its literature and the piece that we had on Monday, How Jacob Emming Fought the Yankees. It's written by Jim Kibler. It's a fun little piece. It's a mix of Faulkner in Attachment to Place and The Twilight Zone. And I don't want to, if you haven't read it yet, I don't want to steal it, you know, steal the thunder of the piece, but it's so interesting. I mean, if you've ever seen the original Twilight Zone, there was a couple of episodes there that were great, and one, and I think this is where, you know, maybe Kibler took the idea just a little bit. I don't know, because I haven't asked him about it, but in one, you have this book that can freeze people, and it takes place during the war, and these Southerners are able to freeze the Union Army from doing their worst, and this is exactly what happens in this particular piece. Jacob Emming is a farmer. His family is being burned out by the Yankees. And he uses this power called using to stop bullets and bayonet charges and fire. And people think of him as this wizard. And it's a wonderful fantasy piece, but tied into history because it has this element of the burning of South Carolina and Sherman's men moving through South Carolina. And of course, that's Jim Kibler. He's a man of place. He's a man of South Carolina. And so it has that attachment to his place and his people there, but it has this interesting component of this fantasy and this, you know, he calls it this old German using. And so I love that. I mean, it's this great mix of historical fiction and fantasy that's, I think, unique. But if you watch these old Twilight Zone episodes and then you read this thing, you're like, oh, yeah, there it is. I mean, this is what we're talking about here. And again, but you get this very Faulkner-esque picture of a people in a place and what they were. And of course, Jim's a very good storyteller. We had last week the review of four of his books. And again, very Faulkner-like in those stories, too. It's Claybank County. Same thing with Faulkner's Mississippi. I mean, this is what you have in this. It's a place. It's a people. And so you got to understand those people in that place and where you're from and these old tales that come out of these areas, folk tales and great stories. And this story of how Jacob Emming fought the Yankees is just wonderful. It's a wonderful little short story and something I recommend everyone read. Of course, you know, Thanksgiving's often known for people going to movies and telling stories and being around family. And here's a great fantasy that would make a wonderful little Twilight Zone type episode. If there's a filmmaker out there to make a little episode, to make a little short, you know, maybe a 20-minute short out of this, it would be great to do that. And it would be a lot of fun to make a little, maybe we need to do that, you know, have an Abbeville Institute movie where you have Jacob Emming fought the Yankees, get Jim to give us permission to make a movie out of it, a little 20-minute movie. You have to have a good filmmaker, somebody that could do it. And then, you know, release the thing and have a lot of fun with it because you get to bash the Yankees. And you also have this, you know, very Twilight Zone type story with it. So it'll be a lot of fun. Perhaps something that could be done. If we have anyone interested in funding that kind of thing, you know, maybe somebody can do that. And then on Friday, We ran a piece, How to Run the American Revolution Belated Device, from Joe Stromberg. And this is, you know, a man writing a letter back to those participating in the American War for Independence, and what you should and should not do. And the idea, of course, is to not get the things wrong. And one of them, was don't ratify the Constitution. don't do this. You know, don't wait for Patrick Henry to tell you what will happen. Just don't do it. And that's the important thing. And his rule number five. This is five rules. Five rules that you know, you should think about. And rule number five was, do all the things recommended above, and you will have some chance of actually obtaining your goals by means of this revolution. Otherwise, your descendants will be harangued in the following manner. And this is from a 1960 book, and this is what the author Charles Black had said in The People and the Court, Judicial Review and a Democracy. He wrote this, quote, "We are all Hamiltonians today. If Jefferson had actually won out, there would have been no TVA. But alas, for those who would count this loss a gain, there would have been no FBI. Neither of these institutions could conceivably be justified on a strict construction of the Necessary and Proper Clause. The Federal Reserve System would have been an impossibility. There would have been no Interstate Commerce Commission, no federal control of marijuana. Investigations by committees of Congress would have been out of the question. The federal organization would have been possessed a number of scattered and discontinuous paper powers." So this is what he's saying. This is what we actually got. So don't ratify that Constitution, because you get Hamiltonian America. We don't want that. Don't ratify the Constitution. Don't join any unions, he said. Stay out of that. Don't do that. Don't volunteer to be in the army. And don't cooperate with any leaders. You know, these people in the Continental Congress. So it's just looking back and saying all the mistakes that we made in the American War for Independence, we replaced one tyranny with another ultimately. And we should have stayed in our states. So this is a fun little piece. Again, a fantasy. Going back in time, writing a letter. It's like Back to the Future. You know, send yourself a telegram. But go back in time with it. It's fun to do these kind of things. It's fun to have these historical inferences, you know, what if. And we often forget that. You know, our side has to be funny. Our side has to be fun. We can't just be serious. I mean, it's often portrayed, you know, Southerners just brooding all the time. We're so serious and brooding. And we can't have any fun. We can't poke fun at ourselves, which is completely not true. All of humor is actually Southern. You look at the greatest comedians in America. They were Southern, or at least they loved the Southern tradition, the Southern people. The most important comedian of the 1930s, Will Rogers, was Southern. You go back to the earliest comedy in America, it's Southern. You look at your most famous comedians around today, many of them are Southern. The funniest comedian of the late 20th century, Louis Grizzard, Southern. But you could just go down. Laurel and Hardy, one of the two, was Southern. You could just go down the list and look at these Southern comedians. You know, the South can poke fun at itself, and the South can write great fiction, and the South can be funny. And the South has that. The reason it can do that is because it is a people in a place, and not just this boring nothingness. I mean, one of the reasons why people are bored of American literature is because they have to read too much New England literature. It's horrible stuff. It's really boring. And Hawthorne is boring. Even though Hawthorne was a different kind. But, I mean, his literature is boring. And this is why people don't like it. I mean, to be frank, it's just boring stuff. But Southern literature is just much more exciting. So much more exciting. So, you know, when we think about the Southern tradition, we think about what that is. We think about, we reflect at Thanksgiving, reflect on the things we're thankful for. Be thankful for where you're from, your people and your place, your family. Your traditions, your culture, be thankful for those things. Be thankful for your ancestors and what they gave to you, what they bequeathed to you and your people. Be thankful for that during this important time of reflection. Be thankful that Virginia was first, because if Plymouth was first, America would have looked a lot different in the colonial period, and we wouldn't have had this tradition to talk about. Now, of course, we live in Massachusetts, America now. But be thankful there's the counterweight to that in the Southern tradition. We can still talk about these things. And maybe, just maybe one day again, the Southern tradition will be ascendant, and we won't be living in Puritan Massachusetts writ large over the 50 states of America, and that we can have a return to those real things, those tangible things that made America great. Until next time, good day.